The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We know what the record is. We know what the record of success is in terms of big government stepping in to solve any problems. And so I think if we are going to see a successful resolution to the crisis in Paris and whatever crisis we may see hither and yon around the world, it is going to boil down to our internal orientation and the values that we live our lives based on.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. There's no way we can start this show without talking about the tragedy in Paris. I had a number of clients ask me this week, knowing that we were going to be recording, just ask, what does this mean? What does this Paris tragedy mean? And, you know, not trying to be shallow, they wanted to know, what does it mean politically? Does it mean something for the markets? What does it mean for the way the international community, from this point on, responds?
So I think it's very interesting, because it adds a new tone to sort of the underlying currents of the markets and of politics, both here in the United States and in Europe.
What amazes me, though, Dave, is how few people can affect an entire world. You know, you look at these guys, there's only a few shooters, there's only a few bombers, and yet the entire world at this point is just shivering in their boots.
Well, and I think it's worth remembering that the impact of a few people can either be incredibly positive or, in this case, incredibly negative. So, not to play Pollyanna, but just as a few people can harm the world, a few people can absolutely change it. And I think this scenario in Paris, it was absolutely unnecessary. It was absolutely blind and misguided. It was absolutely cowardly and cruel. Mm-hmm. And in my view, as a man, I look at it as incredibly unmanly in every way. Strength is there to serve the purpose of protection and care and provision, not violence, not blind rage, not reckless savagery. And so I think the appropriate response is to end that criminality, is to curtail it, is to address the problem at its source. In essence, cut off the head of the snake.
Well, and why don't we start calling it what it is? You know, you talk to anyone in the military right now who's in the Middle East, they understand who the enemy is. We're just not allowed to say it on the news. We're not allowed to say it in public. We're not allowed actually to talk about it at dinner.
Yeah, this is an Islamic problem. And there is no issue in talking about it in those terms when you realize that we had 300 years of benign Muslim existence. And that's all we need, is another 300 years of benign existence. And in every quarter where it's malignant, it needs to be cut out and destroyed.
Right.
And the idea that you can have dialogue with insanity is insane itself. That's not to say that we shouldn't have very constructive dialogue with Muslim quarters that are, as I say, benign. Now you're talking about a reasonable conversation with reasonable people. Mm-hmm. But where you find insanity, it is an insane project to try to reason and come to the table. That's not a place where dialogue can occur.
We in the Western world have gotten comfortable, Dave, especially here in America. We've never been invaded, really, and we have two oceans that have protected us through the years. It's a real blessing, actually, that we've been protected to the degree that we have. But I look at these attacks, and actually, a lot of times the response that we see from our government is, how are we going to keep your sense of comfort and your sense of security and your sense of privileged life alive?
Right. More important than our external social, political, or even military response, it's the internal response, I think, that we have as individuals and ultimately as nations, which are really the expression of or the composite view of our values and our orientation to reality at the national level. And it seems to me, and I would echo what you're saying here, it seems that behind our Western European and American response is a certain frailty. We saw it with 9/11, and we may see it again now. We cling to a way of life as if that is our identity.
Right.
Do you remember George Bush's reaction? Yeah, our way of life has been attacked. That's close to a verbatim quote. And what was his reaction? Well, we were supposed to go out and do our patriotic duty and spend some money. I mean, it seemed very trivial at the time. It's like, well, what does that have to do with anything? But get out and spend some money. And, you know, at the national level, we'll implement the Patriot Act and protect the homeland so that your moral experience goes undisturbed. And perhaps it's a view of the good life, an experience of modern material success. But when we lose it, when we see it fade, we go crazy trying to get it back.
Well, we seem to protect the wrong things. We're trying to protect our ability to spend money. Like you said, when George Bush came out and said, go spend money, it's your patriotic duty, that's another form of insanity. It may seem more civilized, but it's another form of insanity to say that we, as Americans, needed to go spend money. What that does is that just reaffirms that we're protecting something that's not worth protecting.
What it suggests to me is that we're talking about an identity as a people, which is false. Basing our identity on secondary or tertiary things, not only is that false, but it creates false crises in life. If you base your identity on being popular, for instance, then your life and your actions are dictated by that false identity, and all it takes to maintain social status, to avoid disappointing others, or let's say your identity is based on material wealth, then you tend to fear and loathe anything that can reduce you or your wealth, and therefore dent the view you have of yourself as an important individual.
So what you're saying is what we should value are the immaterial things, the things that are the bedrock of what our belief system is.
That's right. The conception that we have of the good life, if it's not grounded in immaterial things, it sets us up for, I think, false and unnecessary crises. We live in a world where, I guess if you brought this back to sort of family dynamics, the fracturing of family has reduced the strength of our individual narratives. And it's those narratives that I think tend to transcend even seemingly unbearable tragedy.
So the question would be, who am I? Where do I come from? A lot of the things that you've been talking about with this intentional family's mindset of the book that you're writing.
Right. What do I value that can't be stripped away from me by a change in the world around me? The family is the place that cultural values and personal identity are crystallized. And without it, identity is too easily confused with the pursuit of becoming a rock star, becoming a professional athlete, a television celebrity. I think you get the idea.
Well, Dave, this may seem a little elusive, but the older I get, the more things start looking the same. I remember growing up, one of my dad's favorite things to do was to go find unique little restaurants that had sprung up somewhere in Denver or wherever we were traveling. The mom and pop places where we could get something that we had never had before. And I think you grew up a little bit that same way, but now you go to these same places and really they're just large chains. And driving through Southern California, you go neighborhood by neighborhood by neighborhood. They start all looking like the same. It's like cookie cutters. People are becoming like that. The distinctions between people, nations, what have you, are becoming less and less to where we really are not allowed to criticize or even appreciate differences anymore, because there shouldn't be.
No, there are some ironies when we consider sort of multiculturalism, the fact that there is a greater homogenization as we champion the politically correct version of multiculturalism, which does anything but celebrate true differences and allow people to say, no, this is what your identity is, and that's okay. I mean, it seems to me that we are in a world with less of sort of those intangible roots to our identity. So we see horrific events occur, and we're tempted to ask those that govern to recreate some sort of a Shangri-La context, the context that we knew before the crisis, which allowed for the pursuit of that false and, quite frankly, frail self.
Remove the friction, basically, is what we're calling for people to do.
Yeah, the cars we drive, the restaurants we eat at, the house we live in, the music we access, our free time, the shows we watch. These are the things that define us to a large degree. And if those things are threatened, then we don't know what to do with the world. We don't know what to do with ourselves. And the governing class loves to offer solutions of an external sort, a patch, if you will. But in my view, it's not helpful in getting to a more significant resolution of determining, number one, what your true identity is as a person, first and foremost, then as a culture. And are we even allowed to have that strong cultural identity in a multicultural age?
I think people are starting to become embarrassed about a strong identity, actually, because we want to be politically correct.
Well, multiculturalism, as we said a minute ago, homogenizes people more than it has, in fact, celebrated differences between them. And homogeneity, quite frankly, can be dangerous. I think of, we just had our first snow of the season, and I'm very excited about getting into the backcountry and doing some skiing. But when snow's on the hillside, it homogenizes after being baked in the sun. And what happens is the unique crystallarity of each individual snowflake becomes just like every other snowflake as it melts and refreezes and melts and refreezes. It actually becomes ball bearing like in its consistency, and it is a massive source of insecurity for the rest of the year. I realize it's maybe an insignificant example of homogenization creating instability, but I think it's not a good idea.
You know, I think of a contrast, Dave, to the way the Europeans have reacted, the way the Americans have reacted. I think of Israel. I think of the Israeli people. You know, you have been over there a number of times. In fact, you lived over there for a while. And my question would be, how is it that you have daily bombings, daily stabbings, daily shootings in Israel, yet you have such a sense of identity in a people? And a lack of this operating in sort of a surface fear.
Well, I don't know that they're hoping that a Shangri-La reemerges, some perfect place where they can exist and have a perfect life. I think perhaps they're more reflective and philosophical or historically in tune with hardship. And I do. I think of the Israeli people as something of a counterexample. Crisis occurs, life goes on. You do what you can to prevent it. But still, life goes on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, what does allow for life to carry on regardless of stabbings, bombings, weekly rocket attacks, suicide missions? Honestly, I can only speculate, but it seems that there is a sufficiently robust cultural identity and an awareness of a shared narrative, that the history of the people, that when bad things happen, panic is not the response. People are not shaken to their core. And again, this is just the way it seems to me. Because the core of those people is not defined by the expectation of ease or a conception of the good life, which is somehow neat and clean or safe.
Well, let's face it, the utopian dream has led to millions and millions of deaths with communism. But you look at Israel, okay, 6 million deaths in what was a utopian dream in Central Europe. Now, freedom, Dave, is messy. We all know that. There is pain involved in freedom.
And there's the tension of bad things happening when you allow for freedom. Jefferson wrote, as he declared our independence from the British, we hold these truths to be self-evident. You know the quote, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And safety is not on the short list.
Right.
Security is not on the short list. Life has always been a struggle, and how we respond to crisis defines the future of our culture. Each culture needs to respond, and this is a key distinction, respond and not react, or quite frankly, that false crisis born out of a very thin and frail identity gives birth to a state apparatus that seeks to give us what we're asking for, mm-hmm. safety and security at the expense of liberty, at the expense of one of those intangibles which have defined our national identity here in the United States since, frankly, before Jefferson distilled it into words.
You know, I think of the pioneer spirit. My wife and I were watching the news this morning, and 3-inch hailstones had fallen in the panhandle of Texas, on Pampa, Texas. And I told my wife, I said, Pampa, Texas, my family pioneered and settled that town and named that town. Now, we look back at that family, and I remember hearing stories of my great-great-grandparents and how they had Indian attacks. They were facing so many things, but they had that American pioneer spirit. And it just reminds me of what Ben Franklin said. Now, everyone's heard this one way or another, but he said it 3 separate times. And I'm going to say it 3 separate times because it's worth it. Ben Franklin said, "They that can give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." In another way, he said, "Those who sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither." And then the third way, he said, "He who would trade liberty for some temporary security deserves neither liberty nor security." I say it 3 times because it's true, Dave. You've got to have one or the other, but we cannot give up our freedoms and our rights and, frankly, our national identity based on an event in Paris, let's say.
Or in New York, or in Washington, D.C., or in San Antonio, or Los Angeles. I mean, the reality is we live with the tension of imperfect people doing imperfect things and having the freedom to express themselves in inappropriate and uncalled for ways. That comes with freedom.
Mm.
But the choice is, would you have it any other way? Yes, we have laws. Yes, we have the ability for people to govern and create some sense of justice for those actions which are hurtful and harmful to other people. But that's the rule of the law.
So, Dave, this failed experiment that has really been put forward by first America and then Europe to try to keep the economy from feeling any stress or friction, you know, really going back to 2007, 2008, 2009, wouldn't it be ironic if this failed experiment sort of revalidates itself in the name of defense against terrorism? Or you see what I'm saying?
Well, sure. Some sort of need within Europe as they struggle from a monetary, financial, even political perspective to keep the union together. Mm-hmm. It is interesting to see sort of the need or the perceived need for a transnational security apparatus to deal with immigration as an issue, which is affecting every country in Europe, and ultimately the threat of terror. Is that the tie that binds a basic level of insecurity? Is that the tie that ultimately binds at the political or transnational level?
Well, remember when we interviewed Otmar Issing, who was the head of the European Central Bank for 7 years, one of the founders of the euro, he fully admitted that a monetary union would ultimately have to be followed by a political union. And he realized also that a crisis would probably be what would bring that about.
Right. So by all means, panic, because government will be there to solve everything if you just give them the leeway to keep you safe. It certainly gives you reason to pause. Now, on this side of the pond, the Paris events may very well determine the 2016 elections. Certainly, they add to a social mood, and that social mood is negative, it's dark, and it is fragile. And so I think the parties that convey calm, communicate confidence, speak very clear policy directions, they're going to stand out more in that context. Mm-hmm. I don't know that nuance is going to be as important. Nuance is lost when the social mood shifts and it moves towards something that is more inherently insecure. So that should be kept in mind, too, as you consider how the markets trade over the next 3 to 6 months. The social mood has shifted, and it can exaggerate a trend, in this case, a negative trend.
Well, do you think then, we're talking politics, but as we look at the financial world has been glossed over with monetary policy, with quantitative easing, with the ZIRP, the zero interest rate policy. Do you think that this social change, this mentality change, could also affect the security felt by this false artificial stimulation?
Yeah, and you're seeing that in Europe. I mean, you've got in Berlin, you've got the wise men of Germany, as they're called, the Council of Economic Experts. Five guys who were quoted last week as saying monetary policy is leading to a buildup of risks to financial stability, which could pave the way to a new financial crisis. Mm. And, you know, what kinds of activities are they talking about? You know, we already know the monetizing of all kinds of assets that Draghi has put in place. And Draghi continues to suggest that he's going to do more and more.
Aren't they even talking about buying municipal bonds at this point? So even saving municipalities?
It's a trial balloon that was floated last week that the ECB may start buying bonds from the likes of the city of Paris and other regions throughout the EU. And yes, the wise old men should be paid attention to. They've seen history, they've studied history, and they've connected the dots between policies and their consequences.
You know, when you look at a chart of recessions, as far as what we would call an official recession, you see the little gray shaded area, and then you see the clear area, then you see the gray shaded area. About every 7 years, you see a recession. Now, it's been officially about 7 years since we've seen a recession. I think the gray shaded area has started, and they don't know what to do because they still employ the same techniques that they were employing when they were trying to get us out of the last one.
Well, I think it's worth noting, as we are through the third quarter earnings season, yes, revenues were down, they were disappointing, but it was very interesting. When earnings were announced by a given company, the disappointments were met with an absolutely punishing and sharp decline, anywhere from 10, 20, even 30% declines in stocks that disappointed on their earnings. And so again, the nature of the backdrop, what I'm suggesting as a social mood, has shifted to the negative. And I think really what it reinforces for corporate executives is that they must play games with earnings. And they've got to play games with the general public too, by lowering expectations to then come in the next quarter and beat those expectations and thus avoid the abuse in the marketplace. You won't see a 10, 20, 30% decline. I mean, Amazon's a perfect case in point. Amazon beat their expectations after suggesting a negative quarter and then announcing a positive number instead. So they said, basically, listen, we're going to lose money next quarter. And then in the third quarter, they come out and, oh, we made money. What's interesting is that the third quarter, they made a lot less money than they did in the second quarter. But that doesn't matter because they beat expectations.
They lowered the perception is what they did.
They lowered the bar and they're still a success as long as they adequately lower the bar. That's what I'm talking about in terms of, you know, lowering the expectations. I suppose if my wife thought I was never going to bring flowers home again and then I brought them home once a year, I'd be a hero relative to her expectations. You know, but again, it's just, have I lowered the bar to be that kind of hero? Well, in the corporate world, that's what they're doing, and they're treating you as that kind of patsy to believe it.
Sometimes there's ways to look at a recession without actually looking at the normal GDP numbers. You can look at inventories. We've talked about that over the last couple of months. But you can also look, I'm thinking of the auto industry right now. I mean, not only will they give you a loan, they'll give you a loan for more than what the car's worth. And you can pay it back in what? Almost a decade.
Earlier in the year, as we transitioned from the first to the second quarter, everyone started saying, well, we're going to have a great finish to 2015. And a part of that was predicated on retail sales picking up. And a part of the retail sales picking up in the first half of the year was, you know, second quarter auto loans driving major purchases of automobiles. We've seen a huge amount of automobiles picked up over the last 2-3 quarters. And, you know, lo and behold, the financing has been easy. We've passed the $1 trillion mark for the first time ever in terms of auto loans, and certainly helps the retail figures for that period. You know, Kevin, you just mentioned this. You can now borrow more than the car is worth. So if the car sells for 30 grand, you can borrow 40. You can extend payments out as far as 8 years. That's insane.
Well, and then don't forget the rebates. I mean, there's still things that you get even after getting your 8-year loan.
That's right. You can get rebates, enticements, if you will, some of them as high as 20% cash back. And it's not exactly what you would view as a healthy market. Even with all these games being played, there in the month of October, auto sales were a disappointment. And the whole retail sector is in the process of worsening. Quite frankly, at this point, we'd have to have a blowout holiday sales season, absolutely beating expectations beyond anyone's belief, to correct the trend lower, which is already in place. We know that Q2 auto sales overseas were not as strong as hoped for. And that, of course, was hit hard by the fact that the dollar was rising. Now you look at the US dollar continuing to rise at near a 10-12-year high, going back to 2003, where it levels last seen in 2003. And I think you're going to see the fourth quarter look even worse in the auto sector from that standpoint.
And it's not just the auto sector at all. I mean, has there been anything that's pointed to retail sales growing anywhere in any sector?
Spoke Investments does some interesting research, and they pointed out that not a single retail sales figure this year has been better than expected. They've all disappointed. So the increase in October was well below what was expected. We already know that the industrial sector is in recession. So again, if the consumer doesn't step in and basically save the economy in the next 6 to 8 weeks, we're going to finish with a whimper, not a bang.
I had mentioned that when I was in college, I was a toy store manager, and we did 75% of our business from Thanksgiving to Christmas. It was an amazing phenomenon to see that inventory.
What percentage?
75% of the entire year's business was from Thanksgiving to Christmas. I mean, this is toys that we're talking about. And it was a large toy store, you know, big name toy store. But one of the things we watched weren't sales. We watched our inventory. And if our inventory wasn't moving at the speed that it needed to, if that inventory started building, that was usually a precursor to a pretty bad year.
Sure. Well, business inventories increased in September, and they increased, and they were actually expected to remain unchanged. You have business sales, which in September declined by 2.8% year on year. And so I think you're right. We're seeing some suggestions that, you know, be launching into 2016 with some real economic challenges. We may, in fact, already be in recession.
Okay, but let's go back to something that we cover virtually every week, the stock market. Let's talk about the Dow. Let's talk about the S&P. What are we looking for? I mean, it's looking sort of feeble right now.
I'm fascinated by how much of a litmus test the Dow and the S&P have become. And it doesn't matter the educational spectrum, whether you're very educated, whether you're uneducated. Everyone alike references these index to gauge whether the economy is doing well or not. It seems obvious to me, is it possible that the economic tide has already gone out and the indexes have the public complacently believing all is well? But literally, when we had the swoon just 6 weeks ago in the equities market, I had conversations with countless people who would say, yeah, I've been really concerned. And 6 weeks later, the stock market is up and, yeah, we really think this is going to be a good year. And literally, their sentiment, how they feel about everything from what they're going to spend for Christmas to you name it, whether they think they're going to get a pink slip or not, it ties to the Dow Industrials or the S&P 500. And so as go those indexes, so goes sentiment.
So if retail sales are down, and we are actually in probably a recession, you know, one of the things I think of is a company will sometimes scale back one of its greatest expenses, which can be advertising dollars. But advertising dollars play even a larger role these days in our economy because of social media. You know, you don't just have television anymore. You have Facebook. You've got YouTube. Advertising seems to play a much larger role these days. And so if we are in a recession, do you see that getting cut?
Well, corporate advertising dollars are easy to cut. That's an easy cut to make. And of course, in this little period of time, we've had some companies that have become sort of bellwethers within the bellwether. You know, people look at Facebook and Google and are very interested in sort of not only the social media aspects and the search engine aspects, but a lot of their daily time on the computer is oriented to these kinds of companies, forgetting that these are the kinds of companies that rely on advertising dollars almost exclusively. So you've got bellwethers within the bellwether indexes, which are incredibly, incredibly sensitive to a shift in economics. Because again, ad revenue, that can be shut off in a heartbeat. And so how quickly can companies like that, again, bellwethers within the indexes, high flying today, how quickly can they lose 60 to 80% of their value? 12 weeks would do the trick.
When you were talking about a litmus test, the stock valuation, you know, Amazon amazes me. Just before we started recording this morning, I was handed a package. I got my latest book from Amazon. You know, it's sitting here on the chair. I'll probably get two or three in the next few days. Okay, I went on a spending spree on Sunday.
No, but tell me, the first concepts of topology, the geometry of mapping of segments, curves, circles, and disks. Can I ask why? I'm not asking why on Amazon. I'm asking why that particular book.
It's the mathematics of shapes, and something just tells me that I need to know something about that.
Okay,
I mean, okay, but going back to what we were saying, Amazon, yeah. There's a lot of things purchased on Amazon, but the shares right now are 900 times the earnings. That's incredible.
The trailing price earnings is 925.
And 14 is a really solid company. If you're buying 14 times earnings is about the level you want to buy at.
Yeah, no, I mean, see, you are getting a deal on Amazon. If you're buying the shares, you're paying for close to 1,000 years worth of earnings, which, you know, you like math. Look at it this way. This is the new math.
Right.
New math for the 21st century. We're thinking big and we're dreaming of a future. And you're paying today for 900 years worth of earnings in Amazon.
And that was the lie of the tech stock boom in the late 90s. They said the economy's changed. You don't have to look at PE, price earnings, anymore. But let's just look recently at what happened back in the crisis of 2008 to Amazon.
Sure. When retail sales started to crater, they may have been an alternative venue from brick and mortar, but in 12 weeks, they shed 60% in the bear market of 2008. It took more like 18 months for them to travel from $112 a share to $6 a share back in 2000, 2001. So 18 months to lose 95% of their value. But I mean, they're companies, which everyone's very keen on today, which are very, very economically sensitive. Again, retail orientation, the advertising space. I think the average investor, well, let's just say this, a little tongue in cheek. You can sleep comfortably knowing that those kinds of shares only represent a small percentage of the holdings that your money managers and mutual funds have for you.
Which you've got to be kidding, because that's actually the majority of what they're holding.
Yeah, no, they are. You're right. They are some of the top holdings for mutual funds and hedge funds. Of course, you can add Apple and Netflix and Tesla to the mix, and therein you've got a couple $1 trillion in market cap that is very economically sensitive and vulnerable to a snap in sentiment.
Well, and we're not just talking about some of the newer tech companies. Look at the old blue. I mean, IBM, we're talking the blue of the blue of the blue for tech stocks, and they're just continually declining in revenues.
When you think of blue chip, if it relates to technology at all, yes, you have to bring in the big blue. And IBM reported its 14th consecutive decline in revenues. They're now at levels that we haven't seen in 13 and a half years. And, oh, they're also under SEC investigation for how they recognize their revenues, which really is not a surprise, given that that company in particular, classically, the master masseuses when it comes to the accounting games that can be played. If it's been done, IBM has done it. They know how to massage anything any different direction. And the SEC is interested in knowing just how they've massaged their revenue recognition.
Well, not just IBM. I mean, something tied to IBM as far as the creation of the microchip, that type of thing. Intel Inside is what it says on the outside of the computer, but Intel, they're struggling as well.
Sure. They're at the heart of Techlandia, if you will, and they've had five sequential quarters of increasing inventories.
Right.
In other words, they're not moving product as they expected. So what happens next? If you're not moving product as expected, here are the dominoes that begin to fall. First, you have trouble with your margins. Then you take a significant financial hit. And as you begin to disclose that, then you see your share price that trades lower and sink.
Dave, we talked 3 weeks ago about a conversation that you had with a very large hedge fund manager that was moving out of shares into cash and then, frankly, into gold. I'm wondering, is this happening amongst some of the other hedge fund managers as well?
Well, we know about the purchase in metals, specifically gold, by Druckenmiller, but there are a couple of others. David Tepper with Appaloosa comes to mind, and I think two or three others which have, in the last 90 to 120 days, been taking every rally in the stock market and dumping stock to lighten the load of equity exposure, specifically U.S. equities. And, you know, the concerns that they've cited, revenue concerns, earnings guidance being lower, interest rate trends, these are all reasons that they've been moving to cash. We are talking about very significant positions. I mean, increasing their cash component north of 30, 40%.
And these are very successful hedge fund managers that tend to buy low and sell high. But low, I mean, let's face it, with gold, it hasn't dropped dramatically, but it's dropped like 13 out of the last 14 days, Dave. So when does this end?
Bill King, who's a regular guest on our commentary and an analyst and money manager out of Chicago, points out that the low point and the turning point in gold, what would be described as a bottom in the price, has occurred roughly every 15 years. He just mentions January 30th, 1970, March 1st, 1985, August 27th, 1999, and frankly, we are very near another one now. In a few weeks, we'll be discussing this with Mark Faber as he joins us as a guest on the program. He's pegged $1,100 as a good price to be buying. Although we may be finding a bottom, gold is not necessarily going to reemerge into a sustainable uptrend until the Fed has lost credibility and until confidence, which is a very, very fragile thing, is shaken.
Isn't it odd that we also are watching the Fed and we're watching the loss of confidence in the Fed being an indicator for the price in the paper market of gold to go up? Yet this last quarter, Dave, the demand for coins and bars, again, I mean, it was huge. It was a couple of 100% over last year.
Well, that's right. From the World Gold Council, third quarter supply-demand numbers were compelling, very bullish in terms of demand for coins and bars here in the United States in the third quarter, up 207%. And that's on par with the purchasing volumes that we haven't seen since the global financial crisis. There are other categories of demand which also grew in the third quarter. Again, I come back to that sort of issue of the Dow as a litmus test. The market is down, and in the third quarter, that's when the market was down. Gold demand was up considerably. The Dow is up right now, and market demand for gold is off significantly. So here in the first part of the last quarter of the year, yeah, we're seeing a decline in volumes here in our office, and certainly as we touch base with others in the industry. And to me, it's one of those things, again, where I think investors are reading too much into the Dow. It's become a place where money can be spent to manipulate sentiment and keep sentiment positive. And again, I think gold and negativity is the flip side of that. But you're suggesting something as well, which is that we're dealing really with the paper price of gold that has been considerably weakened, because we do see a dwindling supply of available physical gold.
Right. We get a chance to watch that. Now, in the interest rate markets, you can sometimes see the reality of the economy coming back in, too. You know, we talk about the markets being managed, and I'll tell you, personally, it's quite disheartening. I was asked, you know, what event will actually move the markets the direction that they should go, and right now I can't name a single event that would be the return of the free market, but the free market always returns. Even in a communist society, the free market always returns. They're always defeated by the free market. I read a quote a couple of days ago in a report, and I thought, you know, I should have remembered this quote. He says, "One thing you can always say about gold is whatever the old high was, it will be broken in the future." That is a truism for gold. It is amazing. You can't say that about anything else.
Well, surprise happens in places that you least expect it. And I think inflationary expectations have been pegged very, very low. And we might very well have a surprise in that area.
But the bond guys are looking for higher inflation, aren't they?
Well, they are. And Goldman Sachs is suggesting that bond traders have actually set unrealistically low expectations for inflation, and that core inflation may be one of those surprises in 2016, an increase in core inflation. And it brings me back to King's thought that maybe we're at a 15-year low in gold, 1970, 1985, 1999, here into the year 2015. King might be right about the bottom in gold consistently occurring every 15 years.
Dave, you've been good about interviewing people who maybe don't necessarily see things exactly the way we do. You know, from the Council on Foreign Relations, Ben Steele. It was an interesting interview because when you're listening to what I would consider the elites are saying, like at the CFR or through foreign affairs, you get an idea of what their motivations are and what their expectations are. And he's been talking about monetary looseness and that we haven't been this loose monetarily since 2011.
Well, right. So I think he does a great job at pointing out what has been fuel to the fire for any sort of economic and or financial activity, and specifically financial activity driven by excess liquidity in the system. Now, what he does is he looks at net global liquidity and says basically, well, the Fed may be tightening, the Fed in the United States might be tightening, but in aggregate, as you said, we haven't been this loose since 2007 or 2008. So if you're thinking in terms of net global liquidity from all sources, then the ECB's activity, the Bank of Japan's sort of print all out, then actually there's quite a bit of liquidity in the system today. The interesting thing is that I thought the global economy had gotten past the point of crisis. That's certainly how it's been advertised. And yet, the quote-unquote powers that be, the central bankers slash central planners, are certainly willing to accommodate the global financial system with liquidity that is on par with what we saw in 2007 and 2008. So why are the crisis measures now surpassing 2007 and 2008 levels? Maybe the answer is all is not well.
It just means that the emergency measures, you know, this patient that's on life support has not really revived. Now, you know, from Ben Steele's perspective, I think he still holds out hope. I think he's actually saying, if I read this right, that I guess this looseness is probably going to just provide more liquidity for the economy.
And I think we should hold out hope, but it comes back to what you said a moment ago about the market reemerging. These kinds of activities submerge the free market, and our greatest hope is allowing them to operate on their own without artificial stimulants. And so Steele argues that these banks, the ECB and the Bank of Japan specifically, they end up purchasing different assets than the Fed, and that they may be more effective in liquefying the private markets, much more effective because, again, they're willing to embrace a broader range of assets.
Well, and I've seen the notes in your books. I've seen the notes in any kind of report that you read. You're continually scribbling on them, and a lot of times you're debating. So let's pretend right now that Ben Steele was here. What would be your question for him on that outlook?
Right. Well, I would probably counter his perspective with a couple of things. One, raising rates in the U.S. will affect U.S. bond yields, and that's going to improve the relative attractiveness of U.S. bonds, which in turn is negative for the rest of the world. Because again, one of the things that he's suggesting is that this excess liquidity overseas is going to serve as some sort of a floor for the emerging markets. And I would just say that, well, to the degree that there is an improvement in U.S. bond attractiveness because of higher yields, that's going to represent something of a sucking sound of liquidity from the rest of the world. The second thing I'd say is, as we were discussing last week, equities, that is the stock market, would be negatively affected by rising rates via what we were discussing in last program, the discounted cash flow models, as individual companies are reassessed given a higher interest rate into that modeling. And quite frankly, as go the U.S. indexes, so go the global indexes to a large degree.
Yeah, and don't corporate profits also suffer here in America as the dollar rises? You raise rates, the dollar goes up.
Well, that's going to be, I think, the third point of contention with Steele. I would say that if the dollar continues to strengthen, then you have steep declines in U.S. corporate earnings beyond what we've already seen. And that becomes a double whammy for the U.S. large caps. So while he tends to see some lemonade, I think I'm still tasting just the lemons.
Well, and you may be tasting a little copper in your mouth as well, because Dr. Copper usually tells you the direction. You know, if you're starting to see a revival, you're going to see it in copper, and we're not seeing that in commodities at all.
Right, right. It's difficult to argue for economic strength fostered by more and sort of disparate central bank liquidity, his net global liquidity, when you see the Bloomberg Commodity Index at a 16-year low. Bloomberg Commodity Index is at a 16-year low. Oil last week dropped, that's West Texas Intermediate, dropped by 8.5%. Pretty big decline for 1 week. Copper was down 3.6% last week. Zinc is at a 6-year low. Gold and silver are weak too, but not nearly as weak as the more economically sensitive commodities, which is telling you something important. It's certainly vis-a-vis dollar strength, the precious metals are holding up all right. But you watch the broader commodities, and I think you need to here in the next few months for significant downdrafts. This is not going to be supply and demand related, but you've got select commodities, which are going to be very volatile into year end. Once you get into January, first week, second week of January, the Goldman Sachs Commodities Index, which ties out to about $60, $65 billion worth of commodities positions, gets reweighted. And it was interesting, over the weekend I had a very informative conversation with a man that produces commodities in Africa. His offices are in London. Very intrigued by his comment that no commodity with a contract attached to it, that is a futures market contract, is behaving in line with supply and demand.
Isn't that amazing?
Fundamentals are being trumped, or trends exaggerated, by the paper trade in those commodities. So you've got the ratio of paper to physical in the gold space. That was a surprise to him, as I shared to him. It had reached over 320 paper ounces for every one physically deliverable ounce at a recent peak. But that kind of trading is occurring in other commodities as well. And he was giving me some insight into the copper market, because he owns some copper mines and has tens of thousands of employees across the globe. And his copper operations, he actually sees the supply and demand dimensions improving, and yet the price is still going lower. Why? Because again, whether it's Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan or any of these trading houses, they're more than happy to trade the paper side and direct the price regardless of the physical supply and demand dynamics.
Well, and it's interesting to listen to the view of someone who actually mines it and brings it out of the ground. I mean, he sees that as an asset.
And so I asked him, you know, your business is not where it was 2, 3, 4 years ago. Is there any place that you think makes sense to sort of batten down the hatches? Is there any place that you think represents good value? And he thought gold in the ground, that is, miners that control the stake but have a resource in ground. He basically said none of the in-ground resources are being counted as if they have any value at all. And he represented that to me as one of the best values in the market today.
Which is amazing because so much of a bloodbath has been in the mining shares. But is it possible that there's enough blood in the streets at this time that a person should consider that?
Well, what is considered good value 6 months, 12 months, 24 months ago, was assuming that some value was assessed to the in-ground resources. And what he's arguing is that actually that's being completely ignored at this point. You can find really good assets and you're getting the in-ground resources for free. So they're basing the value of a company on current cash flow and their ability to service debt and whether they will survive a commodity cyclical downturn, but they're not looking at in-ground resources. So for the man or woman of patience, of conviction, and probably with a cast iron stomach, yes, it's very cheap. To my chagrin, it seems to always get cheaper.
Well, it's sad that I even have to bring this up, because if supply and demand isn't really affecting the price of gold or copper or what have you, anything that's traded on paper, then what we have to do is we have to go back to a statement you made earlier in the program, and that is, gold's going to stay down until people lose confidence in the Fed. So let's look at the Fed. What changes are coming in the Fed? I mean, not just the interest rate changes, but the people who are making the decisions.
Yeah, the cast of characters continues to shift. And as we mentioned maybe 3 months ago, this is not following the advice of William McChesney Martin, who said, please do yourself a favor. Don't hire academics. Certainly don't hire economists to run the Fed, maybe to crunch some numbers and provide insights for you. But the reality is the decision makers need to be non-academics. And it's interesting, next year we're losing Kachur Lakota. He's the Minnesota Fed, one of the super doves, and he's being replaced by a Goldman Sachs guy. Oh. Wunderkind Neil Kashkari, he was involved.
You never hear of Goldman Sachs at the Fed, do you?
Oh, well, you know, according to the Wall Street Journal, starting next year, 14 out of the 17 Fed officials will be either academics or Goldman Sachs alumni. While I'm grateful for a little real-world experience, I'm not sure that a Goldman man ever quits being a Goldman man. It's a little bit like the CIA. Do you ever really get out? Do you ever really retire?
Well, Dave, as we wrap up, I would just want to go back to that individualism that we've talked about before. I think we need to, all of us, start growing back a backbone that maybe we softened up or allowed to be softened up through today's culture. And what I mean by a backbone, I'm not just talking about political and social, but I'm also talking about spiritual and financial. We need to find out those intangibles and stand by them. Let's just take the markets as an example. If they don't represent reality, then we need to have enough backbone to move away from them until they do. Same thing with politics. Instead of trying to play these politically correct games and call an enemy something other than what he really is, we probably need to just step up to the line and start taking action based on what our value system says we should. And so, Dave, as we do these programs and try to inform people of the real numbers, we're not telling people what to do. We're just saying, look, if the social experiment that right now is very, very unhealthy is trying to tell you that it's healthy, you, for your own sake, have to move away and protect yourself. It's a little bit like Paris. Now, no one that I know of knew what was going to go on in Paris. But if you did, you probably would have acted differently. There's this young man, I don't watch much TV, but I do watch Dancing with the Stars with my wife. And one of the young men who was on that Paris train a couple of months ago, who took action when he saw the Kalashnikovs come out, you know, and the terrorists start to take over that train. What did this man do? He and his two other friends, they basically took action. They thought as individuals and they removed the threat. He's just one good example of an American thinking for himself at the right time.
It's an example of just being tough. And I think we explored that with the example of the Israelis earlier. But life goes on. You do what you can to prevent crisis, but unexpected things always occur.
Don't you teach your kids that by making them take cold showers in the morning. You turn it over to the cold for a little while so that they learn, that, like Patton said,
this too shall pass.
Yeah, that's right. You've got to keep
moving. I don't
know if
Patton said that, but this too shall pass. Yeah. And when you're uncomfortable, what do you do? You do the next thing. You don't sit down and cry. You don't forfeit. You don't quit. You don't hang up the cleats. You do the next thing. And having something of a toughness to you, I think, is absolutely necessary. And I think we may see that in the French. I certainly hope we see that in the French. It would be a catastrophic disappointment if what we saw instead was big government stepping in to solve yet another problem. We know what the record is. We know what the record of success is in terms of big government stepping in to solve any problems. And so I think if we are going to see a successful resolution to the crisis in Paris and whatever crisis we may see hither and yon around the world, it is going to boil down to our internal orientation and the values that we live our lives based on.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.